Tonight, I'd like to tell you a story. And you've all heard it already, but I want to tell it in a new way. So I invite you to sit back and relax and listen. Once upon a time, there was a billionaire. He'd had a tough year. What with the collapse of an overseas stock market and several congressional hearings and a great deal of lobbying to protect his interests. He decided he needed to put his feet up, take some me time and relax. But before he went away, he called in his chief investors. They met in the boardroom on the top floor of the skyscraper. And there he turned to the first and gave him $5 million to play with. He turned to the second and gave him $2 million to play with. He turned to the third and gave him $1 million to play with. "You know what to do," he said. "Don't disappoint me." And then he handed down to the wharf, boarded his private yacht and sailed for the Bahamas. Now, the first investor was a real wheeler and dealer. Thanks to his timely donations to all the major political parties, environmental controls had been relaxed. His companies began extracting oil from the tar sands of Alaska and fracking near schools in Pennsylvania and selling lots of brown coal to China. And his energy investments shot through the roof. Thanks to his canny lobbying, governments were locked into contracts which guaranteed profits for the energy companies. And so despite a downturn in domestic usage, he continued to profit. Thanks to his clever campaigns against wind farms and solar panels, small energy producers were driven from the market. And so in this way too, his investments in big energy continued to pay excellent dividends. And thanks to his creative approach to tax law, he was able to send all the profits offshore and pay no corporate tax. And so, over time, he doubled his investment and he made another $5 million. Now, the second investor put his money into manufacturing. Since the relaxation of import tariffs and the migration of work to special economic zones overseas, his investments had been performing well. In Cambodia, when workers fainted and even died from exhaustion, there were always others willing to take their place. In Bangladesh, when one factory collapsed and killed 1,000 workers, another factory and another 1,000 workers quickly took their place. In China and Guatemala and India and Mexico, floods of workers made T-shirts and jeans and sneakers and smartphones for less than a dollar a day. And the branded products were sold in the modern West at terrific profits. And his astute approach to investment soon paid off. Within a few months, he too had doubled his money and made another $2 million. The third investor, well, he was afraid. He was a man of the world and he knew how money is made. As a young man, energetic, ambitious, he'd done very well for himself. But something had changed. He continued to invest by day, but with an increasing sense of unease. And at night, well, at night he was haunted. He would wake and hear the groans of those who'd worked all day, all week, all month, all year, and were still hungry and still poor and still wretched. In the morning, when he checked his portfolio, he found himself thinking of the garment workers in Indonesia and the tomato pickers in California, and the technology workers in Shenzhen. All those who work, work, work for other people's gain. No matter how hard he tried to suppress them, the groans of the people haunted him. And the words of the prophet Isaiah kept coming to mind. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their own fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be. And my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labour in vain. When he received the million, he felt sick. He thought back to the global financial crisis. His boss had taken a government bailout and used it to award himself a $40 million bonus. Meanwhile, he'd let thousands of workers go and foreclosed hundreds of thousands of homes. Only last week, while being driven to a meeting, the investor had glanced up from his smartphone and noticed tents on land zoned for redevelopment. Children were playing among the broken bottles and the pizza boxes, the used condoms and the syringes, and he'd realised that this was their home. In that moment, a fragment from the Torah had come to mind. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who's not partial and takes no bribe, who executes justice for the widow and the orphan, and who loves the strangers, providing them with food and clothing. Oh yes, he felt sick. He thought of his boss, a man who holidayed on his yacht while his staff worked 90-hour weeks, a man who pushed down wages and cut costs at every turn, a man who undermined or ignored environmental and workplace safety laws, a man who took government handouts but paid nothing in tax. He thought of all the times when his boss had been angry and screamed obscenities at his staff. He remembered watching the spittle fly as he called them slackers and bludgers and assholes and worse. And he wondered, why do I work for him? He thought of the work itself. He was so tired of being on the treadmill, slaving at the office all day and whining and dining clients all night. He hated the person he was becoming, ruthless like his boss, cruel to his underlings, merciless in his investments, and seeking only money and status and power. No matter how hard he worked, he never seemed to have enough. He was never satisfied. And he wondered, why am I so hungry? He thought of his wife. He was tired of the spending in the houses, the holidays, the restaurants, the haircuts, the jewellery, the smartphones, all that stuff that seemed to be taking over their lives. And he wondered, is this the only way to live? But what else could he do? He knew how to be an investor. If he left this work and this career, how would he pay for the mortgage and the holiday house, the nice suits and the leather shoes, the skiing and the trips? What would he eat and where would he live? What would his wife say or their neighbours or their friends? And how would the boss react? His head was spinning, his stomach churned. He felt weighed down by the responsibilities and sick at heart. Unable to think straight, he stood up. He left the office and went for a walk, for it was in walking that he often found peace. He paid no attention to where he was going. He let his feet guide him. And eventually he wound up on the other side of town, near the lake. And at the barbecue area, he saw a ragtag bunch, a mob of tired women and snotty children, and hippies and hobos with long and straggly hair. And they were all listening to a storyteller. As he came near, he heard the storyteller say, "You cannot serve two masters, for a slave will either hate one and love the other, or be devoted to one and despise the other. You can't serve God and wealth. Therefore, I tell you, don't worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you'll wear. Isn't life about more than food, and the body more than clothing?" The man paused. The words were balm. And as he paused, the storyteller looked up and their eyes met. In that instant, all the love in the world poured into his soul. But it was too much. It was too much. His eyes filled with tears as he rocked back. And then he turned on his heel, shook his head once and went home. That night in bed, he tossed and he turned. He punched his feather pillows. He twisted in his linen sheets. He adjusted his silky pyjamas, trying to get comfortable. But the problem was not the bed. He was being kept awake by thoughts, by a self at war with itself, by questions which spun round and round. Who is my master? He asked himself. What do I serve? He tossed and turned and wondered and argued. But as dawn broke, things became clear. He rose and showered and dressed with a strange sense of calm, and then he went into the office. And there he arranged to remove his master's money from the stock market. And he took the money and put it in a safe deposit box and hid away the key. A great weight lifted off him, and he realised there was nothing he needed to do now. With the money locked away, he didn't need to manage it. He didn't need to watch the stock market or keep an eye on his investments or read the financial news. He looked around the office at the colleagues staring into their screens, their foreheads frowning anxiously, shouting into their phones, red-faced and panicky, checking their accounts, eyes glittering with greed. He looked around and shook his head once, and then he walked out. He went to his house so quiet in the middle of the day. He kicked off his nice shoes and he threw off his tasteful suit, and he left his watch with his keys and smartphone on the nightstand. He pulled on his old gardening shorts and a ratty T-shirt that he kept hidden from his wife, and some battered old sneakers. He left the house and he headed to the other side of town where the other side of us all live. And he walked among the homeless and the hookers and the druggies and the dropouts, the alcoholics and the asylum seekers. He walked among the chronically ill and the chronically unemployed and the chronically convicted. And as he walked, he looked. And he hummed to himself as he went walking and looking. A man in search of a storyteller.